Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. We have two good programs for you today. We're going to start off with an episode of Hollywood Star Playhouse called Nor Gloom of Night, starring Alan Young from 1952. And also from 1952, we'll follow that with an episode of Dangerous Assignment and the assignment Ghost Hunters. So that sounds kind of interesting, and we'll be finding out about that in about 30 minutes. Right now, Hollywood Star Playhouse.
This is Alan Young with a welcome to Hollywood Star Playhouse, brought to you by the Bakers of America.
Hollywood Star Playhouse, 30 minutes of mystery, thrills, drama by Hollywood's finest writers, featuring Hollywood's top stars. Brought to you by the Bakers of America through the cooperation of your baker. Hello there, this is Wendell Niles. In a moment, we'll bring you Act One of today's partially transcribed story, Nor Gloom of Night, starring Mr. Alan Young. You know, it wasn't so long ago that most of our women baked their bread at home. But today, 95% of the many millions of loaves of bread we Americans eat every day, we buy from our bakers. And this is true only because choice fresh bread is made readily accessible every day in food stores and in supermarkets everywhere in our nation through large-scale methods of baking in plants across America, through fast modern means of distribution. Yes, baking for the tables of America is a big business. For aside from bread, who but our bakers could turn out such a varied assortment of pies, cakes, pastries, rolls, cookies, and donuts? So for variety, convenience, economy, for nutritious good eating, let the Bakers of America help you serve better meals through bakery foods. And now, Act One of Nor Gloom of Night, starring Mr. Alan Young.
Well, I guess maybe it's partly my fault that this thing happened. You see, the trouble with me is I've got too much imagination. That is, for a postman. Most generally, people think it's a pretty dull job carrying a sack of spring sale ads, wish you were here cards, and Reader's Digest down West Side Avenue, twice on weekdays and once on Saturday mornings. But to me, it's more than that. Like the time when I delivered my Christmas loads during a hurricane.
You can't go out there, Ernie. As postmaster of Greenbrier, Indiana, I forbid it. You'll be blown to pieces.
Haven't got any choice, Mr. Henderson. You know what they say? Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. That's what they say. And people on my route are expecting these packages, and I'm going to deliver them, no matter what. Of course, that story may not be exactly true. It's Mr. Henderson who's always quoting about neither snow nor rain. And it wasn't quite a hurricane. Ain't never been one in Indiana. But it was an unusually strong wind for that time of year. Well, as you can see, I sort of like to exaggerate things. It never did a bit of harm. At least, it never did before. Now, I'm not sure. It all started a week ago last Wednesday. I had a normal afternoon load of mail, and I'd reached Ms. Whitcomb's place down near the end of my route, right on schedule.
Good afternoon, Ernie. I'll take those.
Regulations say mail's supposed to be put in the mailbox, Ms. Whitcomb.
Ernie.
Here you are. Three letters and an ad for Sullivan's sale on two-piece bathing suits.
It's better.
Well?
Oh, my sister in Biloxi. Hmm? That's in Mississippi, Ernie.
Yes, ma'am. Hey, hear about the fire at the Rialto Theater last night? Practically destroyed the whole building.
My son's getting married next July. Suppose that means another wedding present.
Probably won't be able to show any movies for 2-3 months. It'll just about mean building a whole new theater.
There wasn't any fire, Ernie.
Sure there was. Why, I...
Mrs. Arthur told me somebody dropped a match in the wastebasket in the gentleman's lounge. They had it out before the fire department even got there.
Oh. Yeah. Well, it could have been mighty serious, couldn't it?
What's this?
Guess I better get a move on. I'll be behind schedule. See you tomorrow morning, Miss Whitcomb.
Just a minute, Annie.
Yes?
Are you under the impression that Mr. C.W. Whitney lives at this address?
Why, no, of course not. The Whitneys live in the next block.
Then why are you delivering their mail to me?
What? Oh, I must have made a mistake. The names look kind of alike, I guess. Whitney, Whitcomb. I'm glad you caught it before... You didn't open it, did you?
Certainly I opened it. You handed it to me.
Well, you should have looked at the address, Miss Whitcomb.
Don't try to blame me for your mistake, Danny. I wonder why anyone in New York would be writing to Mr. Whitney. Be a friend. Funny way to begin a letter.
Now, you give that back, Miss Whitcomb. You mustn't read it.
Arrangements are satisfactory. We can conclude our business at 7:30 on Thursday night.
It's against the law to read other people's mail.
The property at the corner of 3rd and Parkway will be ideal.
It's a federal offense, that's what it is. If you don't stop reading
that,
well...
Oh, here, Ernie. That's all there was to it anyway.
I once heard of a fellow who got 15 years in prison for opening a letter. It wasn't his.
I'm sure you did.
Now, if I can... Get it sealed up again. Mr. Whitney might not notice.
I don't think it'll make any difference, Mr. Whitney, one way or the other.
Maybe. Well, if he doesn't look too close, it might get by. Still, it wasn't right of you to read it, like taking the law in your own hands.
You delivered it to me.
That was an accident. I ought to report you to Mr. Henderson.
Oh, honestly, the way you exaggerate, Ernie. You'd think I'd done something terrible.
Well, you have. You've made me 3 minutes late. That's what you've done.
I'm hardly responsible for the inefficiency of government employees. It's enough that I pay your salaries.
Well, when I got to the Whitney's house, I walked up onto the porch as quiet as I could, hoping I'd be able to slip the letter into the box without Mrs. Whitney or anybody seeing me. Wouldn't you know that was the one day I'd have trouble getting the box to open? Something must have hit against it, because one corner was bent tight.
Having trouble, Ernie?
Huh? Ooh. Oh, Mr. Whitney. What are you doing home today?
Just a touch of laryngitis. Thought I'd give my voice a little rest.
Sorry to hear that. Here's a letter for you.
Thanks.
Well, so long. Anything wrong, Mr. Whitney?
What do you mean?
About the letter.
Why, no. Of course not. It's nothing but an advertisement.
Somehow it didn't strike me funny when he said it. Almost anything nowadays can be turned into an ad. Besides, I had other things to think about. I was busy trying to make up for lost time. And I finished up the afternoon right on the dot. Well, maybe I was a minute late, but not more. And that's the truth, so help me. Anyhow, next day was Thursday, beginning of the month, so you could see what that means. This month's bills, last month's bills, and for some of the folks on my route, they have to go back even further. And to top it off, the Phillips Airedale nipped the back pocket out of my brand new uniform. Don't know how he does it, but the dog can always tell when I'm wearing one of my good outfits. Well, by Friday morning, I'd forgotten all about Mr. Whitney's letter, and I was having breakfast in the diner across from the post office. I'd been reading the paper for maybe 3-4 minutes. The article was on the second page.
Here's your eggs, Ernie.
Thanks, Alice. Hit and run victim. Miss C.W. Whitney. Miss C.W. Whitney was killed yesterday evening about 7:30 p.m. by a hit and run gray coupe while she and her husband were crossing 3rd Street at the corner of Parkway Avenue. Due to the light rain... 3rd and Parkway.
You know, that vacant lot near the school.
Alice, has Chief Gordon been in yet?
Well, of course not, Ernie. He never has breakfast before 9. You know...
When he comes in, you tell him I want to see him as soon as I finish my morning delivery.
All right, Ernie, but... Hey, aren't you going to finish your eggs?
Yeah.
Yeah, they sure do a fine job on electric trains these days. Never saw one as real as this.
Look, you've got to listen to me, Mr. Gordon. You're the chief of police. You're the only one...
Watch out, Ernie. It's going to jump the track. No, sir, she made it. How do you like that for a sharp turn?
Won't you switch that off for a minute, please?
Well, tomorrow's Freddy's birthday. I got to test the train before I give it to him. May not get another chance.
Isn't a murder more important than birthday presents?
It would be if there'd been a murder. Now, you listen to me, Ernie. I talked to Mr. Whitney last night. He was all broken up about his wife's death.
He was just acting or something. I tell you, he had a letter about it, setting up the whole thing. He hired him to do it.
Accusing a man of something like that is pretty serious, Ernie.
Oh, I know.
Now, I know. You got a way of building a thing up, and
you don't have to believe me, Chief Gordon. Miss Whitcomb read the letter. Ask her about it.
Well, it isn't that I don't believe you exactly, Ernie. It's just that you jumped to such radical conclusions.
Ask Miss Whitcomb what the letter said.
I might send somebody by later. Right now, the deputies are both trying to get a cat down from the telephone pole behind Cook's drugstore.
Couldn't you talk to her yourself?
Afraid that wouldn't do much good. Mrs. Whitcomb's got kind of a grudge against me. I judged against her watermelon pickles at the county fair 3 years ago. She ain't forgot it.
If somebody being killed is just a joke to you...
It's no joke to me, Ernie, but I'm not so sure about that imagination of yours.
Chief Gordon, I'm telling you the truth, so help me.
Well, all right. I guess it can't do any harm to talk to Mrs. Whitcomb. Now, help me put this track away first, and be careful you don't bend it.
Well, I never heard of such a thing, accusing me of reading other people's mail. Don't you think I know it's against the law?
Nobody's accusing you of breaking the law, Mrs. Whitcomb. It's just that Ernie says...
Ernie says. Well, he threatened to make trouble for me, but I never thought he'd go this far.
This isn't about you, Miss Whitcomb. It's about Mr.
And
Whitney.
You, Chief Gordon, believing such an outrageous lie. Why, everybody knows you can't put any stock in a word, Ernie says.
Mrs. Whitcomb, I'm afraid you don't understand.
There's nothing I want to understand. I did not read any letter addressed to Mr. Whitney. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Mrs. Whitcomb.
Then you'll have to excuse me. I'm putting up some pickles. Not that you know anything about pickles, Chief Gordon.
She did read it. She stood right here and opened it and read it.
Come on, Ernie.
But, Chief Gordon, I'm telling you, that letter...
Ernie, even if there was such a letter, what does it prove? All it says is Mr. Whitney's interested in some property at 3rd and Parkway, and there's a deal concerning it, and there's something about 7:30 on Thursday night. Mr. Whitney and his wife go down there, maybe to look it over again or something, maybe to conclude the deal. There's an accident. Mrs. Whitney is killed. Now, doesn't that make just as much sense as jumping to the idea that he took her there so somebody could murder her?
But why did he lie to me about the letter, then?
Some people like to keep their business private. Well, Ernie?
Okay. Okay, I guess it could have happened that way. Maybe it was true. Maybe Mr. Whitney and his wife were just out for a walk, but I just couldn't believe it. I wasn't sure why until the next morning when I walked up Mr. Whitney's steps with a 5 or 6 sympathy cards addressed to him. It was just as he opened the door that I remembered something in that newspaper item. A man who stays home from work with laryngitis doesn't go out for an evening walk, not when it's raining.
Good morning, Ernie.
Morning. I want to tell you how sorry I am about Miss Whitney.
Thank you, Ernie. I understand.
Here's your mail. I don't suppose you'll be buying that property now.
Property?
On 3rd and Parkway, where the accident happened.
What are you talking about?
Isn't that why you were there? Some kind of business deal?
What gave you that idea?
I don't know. I heard it somewhere, I suppose.
Why? As a matter of fact, I was thinking about buying on that corner, but I didn't know that anyone here knew about it. I was carrying on the negotiations by mail.
I guess you can't keep anything a secret in a small town like this.
I guess not. You haven't been reading my mail, have you, Ernie?
No, of course not.
I didn't think you really had. You know, that can get you into a lot of trouble.
We'll return for Act Two of Nor Gloom of Night, starring Mr. Alan Young, in just a moment. But first, I want you to hear some sounds that are familiar all over our country this time of year. Let me open the window. Ah, there's the music of America. Youngsters hard at play, getting plenty of good, healthy exercise, burning up lots of energy. And Mother, when mealtime rolls around these days, be sure that your hard-playing youngsters get plenty to eat and plenty of the right kind of food. One food that is always right for children is enriched bread, because bread enriched with important vitamins and minerals is energy-rich food. In fact, bread is lots of good foods in one: flour, milk, shortening, yeast, sugar, and salt. Foods generous in proteins and calcium. And isn't it encouraging to know that while your children are eating enriched bread, they're getting the wonderful health-giving vitamins of the B complex, elements every child needs every day to maintain a well-balanced diet? And of course, Mother, you know that bread supplies lots of food for very little cost. For bread supplies more nutritive value, penny for penny, than any other food eaten every meal. So serve enriched bread at each meal, every day, to help keep your family healthy and strong. And now, Act Two of Nor Gloom of Night, starring Mr. Alan Young.
By the end of the week, I'd made up my mind to forget all about Mr. Whitney and his wife's death. Maybe Chief Gordon was right. Maybe I had put two and two together and come up with five. When you get in the habit of elaborating on things, you sometimes forget just what's the fact and what you sort of threw in for good measure. But after lunch, that was on Friday, something happened that proved I'd been right for sure. Yes, sir, I'd been right for dead sure.
West, north.
I was arranging my mail as the sorting clerk tossed it in the west side bin. It was a heavy load for an off-season. There was a lot of out-of-town stuff because the westbound trains had been held up by a tremendous hailstorm the day before. Matter of fact, I hardly noticed the letter at first. I just stuck it in the back of my pouch with the rest of the first class. And then I remembered that spidery handwriting, that New York postmark, and the same square envelope.
Ernie, you must be out of your mind. This post office is not going to open a letter just because you happen to think it's important.
But it's from the same man, Mr. Henderson. We can read it and find out who it is. Have him arrested.
For what?
For murdering Ms. Whitney. This letter will prove it. He's probably trying to get more money for doing it, or maybe he's blackmailing Mr. Whitney. Or maybe...
This is utter nonsense, Ernie.
Or maybe Mr. Whitney's hired him to murder somebody else. Sure, that's what it is? Sure, don't you see, Mr. Henderson? That's why he's writing again. Don't you see?
No, I do not.
Somebody else is going to get murdered, Mr. Henderson. I'm positive.
Now, you listen to me, Ernie. This is a perfect example of the way your mind works. First, you come in and tell me you found a letter that looks like one you delivered before. The next thing I know, you're certain it's from the same man. Then you decide it's a blackmail note, and now you're yelling that it's a plan to murder somebody.
I'm not asking you to take my word for it, Mr. Henderson. Just unseal that envelope and read it. If I'm wrong, you can put it back together again.
Ernie, I knew your father. He was a fine man and an honest one. And I'm going to talk to you just as he would if he were still alive. Son, this overdeveloped imagination of yours, perhaps it doesn't do much harm as a rule.
I didn't imagine this letter, sir. It's right here in my hand.
But when your daydreams cause you to suggest tampering with the United States mail, they're dangerous. Downright subversive to the operation of this post office. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, sir.
Furthermore, in the future, please remember that your job is to deliver the mail. The post office department is not in the business of catching murderers.
All right, Ernie. You may go.
You're, let me see, 12 minutes late on your route already.
But, Mr. Henry...
There are plenty of applicants for the job of mail carrier, Ernie.
That afternoon, West Side Avenue seemed twice as long as it ever had before. And that letter in the first-class section of my bag felt like I weighed a couple of tons. In 5 minutes, I'd get to Mr. Whitney's house, and then it'd be too late. He'd just look at the envelope, stick it in his pocket, and slam a door, and there'd be nothing I could do to stop him. Anyhow, I glanced up and saw Ms. Whitcomb peering out the window waiting for her mail. Then I got an idea. I pulled the square envelope out of my pouch and held it in my hand.
Well, Ernie, by the time you got here, I've been getting my drapes all unpleated, staring out the window.
I'm right on schedule, Ms. Whitcomb.
Suppose you are. Don't see why. Just because I live out at the west end of town, I have to get my mail an hour later than anybody else. What are you waiting for, Ernie? Give it to me.
Yes, ma'am.
Wonder if there's anything from my aunt. Last I heard, she was getting better. Suppose that means she's going to die.
That square one's from out of town.
Oh, New York postmark. Well, suppose she might have had a son mail it for her. He works in the city. Well, good afternoon, Ernie.
Aren't you going to open it?
That's what one usually does with mail, Ernie, and I'm quite capable of reading my own letters without your help. Ernie! Ernie Evans, come back here.
Yes, Miss Whitcomb?
Just what do you think you're doing, young man?
Why, I...
This letter's for Mr. Whitney, and you know it.
You mean you opened it?
I did no such thing. You and that so-called police chief aren't going to trick me into reading somebody else's mail. Here's the letter, just exactly the way you gave it to me. Good day.
I put the square envelope in the back of my pouch and tried hard not to think about it as I kept walking on down the block. But as I stepped over the Jenkins kid's roller skates, I found myself wondering who was going to be killed this time. Then I remembered. Ms. Whitney had a sister living over on the north side. Maybe she was the one. I'll bet that's it. As soon as I get off my route, I'll telephone her. I'll warn her to... I reached into my pouch for the next delivery. I pulled out three cards and a square envelope. I was at the Whitney house. Now I had to deliver the letter. I looked up, expecting Mr. Whitney to be waiting for me, but he wasn't there. All the shutters were closed tight, and welcome mat was gone from front of the door. I didn't go directly to the mailbox. I don't know why exactly. I felt that I wanted to see Mr. Whitney face to face. Maybe I had the nerve to tell him, but he couldn't get away with it. Not this time. Maybe I'd be able to say, I know what you're up to. Or maybe I'd be too scared to say anything. Then I saw the slip of pink paper stuck in the corner of the mailbox. Change of address form. C.W. Whitney. New address, general delivery, New York City. The envelope was still in my hand as I walked down toward the corner of 11th Street. I knew why Mr. Whitney left town. Now he'd have a perfect alibi for the second murder. Maybe the killing was already over. Maybe there was nothing I could do, or maybe it was only a matter of hours or minutes. I'd never know unless I opened the letter. I pushed through the gate of the corner house and, from force of habit, looked around for Tony the Airedale. He wasn't in sight. Ms. Phillips was down on her hands and knees, weeding her marigold plants.
Hello, Ernie. You're right on time. I always know when it's 4:30. You're never more than a minute off.
Yeah, I guess so. Here's your mail.
Thank you. Isn't very exciting. Oh, is that other letter for me?
No, it's not.
Well, you look tired, Ernie. Would you like a cup of hot tea? It won't take a minute.
No, thanks, Miss Phillips. I better be getting along. See you tomorrow.
All right, Ernie.
Down, Tony. Oh. Down, get away.
Tony, you bad dog, get down. I've got his collar, Ernie. You better run. Tony, you're a wicked dog. Ernie never tried to hurt you.
I was almost to the corner when I stopped and caught my breath and shifted my pack around. Then I realized I didn't have the letter. It had been in my hand when Tony had charged at me. I must have dropped it.
From across the Phillips fence, I could see it, a white square on the red brick wall. Tony and his mistress had disappeared, so I opened the gate and reached for it. Tony had come around the house and beat me to it. He set up a guard over the letter. He was worrying the envelope with his teeth. Here, Tony. Give it to me. Nice dog. You don't want to eat that, Tony. Here, I'll just... Listen, Tony, I gotta have that letter. It's important. Give it to me, Tony. Give it to me. Tony, let go! The envelope had been chewed open, and the bottom half of the letter was in shreds. I stepped off the curb and started across 11th Street, trying to stuff the letter back in the envelope. And then I saw what it said. Honest, I couldn't help it. It said, "Dear friend, new arrangements are satisfactory. We can stay the appointed courier at 4:30, corner of West Side and 11th. He's never late." You know, never thought I'd be grateful to the Phillips dog. But if he hadn't made me late, I'd have been in the middle of the street. The gray coupe would have hit me instead of that telephone pole. As it was, it snapped the pole in two and didn't stop till it was halfway into the Phillips living room. Well, maybe not quite that far. But it did hit the pole. You can see the big gash in it. And that's the truth. So help me.
Alan, we love you for that. You certainly chalked up a good one for our series. I hope you'll come back again real soon.
You won't ever ask me twice, Wendell, particularly if I can always work with people like Virginia Gregg, Gene Tatum, Jeanette Nolan, Herb Vigran, Parley Bear, and Paul Frees. Thanks a lot, folks.
Thanks again, Alan. We'll hear about the star of next week's Hollywood Star Playhouse show, Mr. Lee Bowman, right after our Bakers of America home economist, Miss Helen Reed, gives you an ounce of suggestion about pound cake. Miss Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Niles. The uniced pound cake you can buy at your bakery, at any food store or supermarket, is one of the best friends a dessert-minded housewife ever had. It's a cake you can serve loads of different ways. And here's one way you might like to try. Peach shortcake a la mode. Cut half-inch slices of your pound cake. Then, from brick ice cream, also cut half-inch slices. Sandwich the ice cream between two layers of cake. Then cover each serving with peaches, either fresh, frozen, or canned. And if you feel like really splurging, add a dash of whipped cream on top. Peach shortcake a la mode is the sort of dessert that takes only a moment to fix, but it looks and tastes as deluxe and delicious as something that might have taken hours of preparation. Why not buy a pound cake tomorrow? Taste what grand desserts you can make with it.
Thank you, Miss Reed. And now here's a word about next week's thrilling story on Hollywood Star Playhouse starring Mr. Lee Bowman.
You know what you want, so you wait, because it's big enough to wait for. And you figure out how to work it when the time comes. Then you find you are walking towards death because you've stepped into the wrong pair of shoes.
Alan Young will soon be seen in the RKO production, Androcles and the Lion. Light's partially transcribed story was written for Mr. Young by Robert Libet and Frank Burt. The entire production is under the direction of Jack Johnstone. All characters and incidents were fictitious, and any similarity to actual characters or incidents is purely coincidental. This is Wendell Niles inviting you to be with us again next Sunday for the Bakers of America program, Hollywood Star Playhouse. Enjoy another half hour of fine entertainment brought to you direct from Hollywood by your baker. The baker who supplies your grocer, the baker who calls at your door, and the baker in your bake shop. All helping you serve better meals through bakery foods.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Well, poor Daddy, played by Hanley Stafford, has his hands full again. Snooks must have her tonsils removed, and it was only by promising her tons of ice cream that Daddy managed to get her down to the surgeon's office. As the scene opens, we find them both entering the waiting room. Listen.
Oh, come on, Snooks. Don't hang out there in the hall.
What's in there, Daddy?
Nothing. It's only the surgeon's waiting room.
Where's the surgeon?
He's not in here. Come on. Oh, come on in.
I'm far enough, Daddy.
You can't stand there in the doorway like that.
Why?
Because I have to close this door.
Well, where's the ice cream?
You'll get plenty of ice cream after the doctor takes your tonsils out.
I'm coming in.
Oh, stop that. There now. Sit down.
I'm scared, Daddy.
Oh, Snooks, you said you were going to be very brave. It's just a minor operation. In 15 minutes, the doctor will have your tonsils.
Why don't he get his own tonsils?
Well, I won't talk about that now. I just don't have any fears. Oh, come on, Snooks. Laugh for Daddy. Stop it.
How are my tonsils back?
Nobody's touched your tonsils. Besides, the doctor will probably give you several tests before he operates.
Why?
Well, I imagine he'll want to check your coagulation and look at your hemoglobin.
I ain't wearing any, Daddy.
You don't wear hemoglobin. It's just the coloring matter of the red blood corpuscles. Oh, here comes the nurse.
Take me home, Daddy.
Hello, Mr. Higgins.
Oh, hello, miss.
Hello, Snooks. Let me see your hand, dear.
What are you going to do with that needle?
I just want to prick your finger. You won't even feel it.
What for?
Oh, don't be afraid, Snooks. Here, nurse, I'll hold a hand.
I want some ice cream.
There, it's all over.
Is my tonsils out?
No. The nurse just took a sample of your blood so she can take a blood count. Isn't that right, nurse?
That's right. Just rest now, dear.
Where's she going with my blood, Daddy?
Into the laboratory.
I want to go there, too.
Oh, you can't go, Snooks. They don't allow anybody but doctors and nurses in there.
Where's the doctor?
I don't know. He might be tied up with a patient.
Is he going to tie me up?
He doesn't tie anybody up. He'll put you to sleep when he works on you.
I don't want to sleep. I want some ice cream.
Oh, soon. Say, look at the funny-looking skeleton.
Where?
Right there in the case. That's what the inside of you looks like.
You too?
Why, of course. Everybody has one of those inside of him.
Who does that one belong to?
Oh, that skeleton belongs to the doctor.
How did he get it out?
He didn't get it out. It was made for him by a medical supply company.
Don't he like it?
Certainly he likes it.
Why don't he wear it?
That's an artificial one. The doctor studies with it. Well, you feel a little better now, don't you, sir?
I feel fine. Let's go home.
Now, listen. If I thought anything would happen to you, I wouldn't have brought you here, would I?
Wouldn't you?
Of course not. This man is one of the best surgeons in the country. He never hurts anybody.
No!
What's that, Daddy?
I suppose he's working on a patient.
With a hatchet?
Now, don't be silly. I told you he never hurts anybody.
Daddy!
What's going on in there, nurse?
The doctor was scrubbing up and he burned his own hand. He's ready for the little girl now, Mr. Higgins.
Oh, Daddy.
Oh, come on, Snooks. Nothing to worry about. That's a good girl. Oh, hello, Doctor.
Well, hello. Come right in, sweetheart.
Where's the man?
What man?
The one you killed with the hatchet.
Oh, Snooks. She's awfully upset, Doctor.
We'll soon fix that. Doctor.
Yes, Doctor.
What's all the doctors for, Daddy?
Prepare a sedative for the child, please. Preoperative.
Phenobarbital, half grain?
It's indicated.
Yes, Doctor.
Who's he, Doctor?
He's my anesthetist. Oh. Very capable. Now, let's have a look at the child's throat. Now, just sit back in this soft chair, my dear.
If you touch me, I'll bite your nose off.
Snooks.
Phenobarbital, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor. Will you administer?
Certainly, Doctor. Here, little girl. I've brought you a nice piece of candy. Swallow it with this water.
You think I'm a dope, don't you?
What's the matter with you, Snooks?
That ain't candy.
Sure it is. It's wonderful.
Well, you eat it.
Never mind, I'll handle her. Iodine swab, please, Doctor.
Yes, Doctor.
Now, Snooks, just close your eyes and open your mouth.
I don't wanna.
I won't hurt you.
What do you got behind your back?
Nothing, nothing at all.
I know what it is.
What is it?
It's the hatchet you kill the man.
Oh, Snooks, stop carrying on like that. He only wants to look at your tonsils. Heavens, when I was your age, they looked at mine hundreds of times. And I was never afraid.
You sit here.
Oh, my tonsils are all right. But just to show you, I'll sit in the chair and let the doctor do anything he likes.
A good idea, Mr. Higgins. It'll give the child confidence.
Yes, of course. Now, let me sit down, Silk. Now, see how wide I open my mouth?
If you chopped out your tonsils with a hatchet, you won't holler?
Why, certainly not.
Chop them out, Doctor.
Oh, my tonsils are perfect. Aren't they, Doctor?
Well, one of them is a little inflamed.
Huh?
Seems to be a necrosis in the glossopalatine fold, Doctor.
Hmm, a very interesting case.
I'd love to get my hands on those tonsils.
Now, wait a minute. This is ridiculous. My tonsils are in great shape.
Are you scared, Daddy?
No, I'm not scared.
I'd have those removed if I were you, Mr. Higgins.
We'll discuss that later. Snooks, get back in this chair.
I got a good look at her throat then. Did you see, Doctor?
Yes. Shall we prepare?
If it's all right with Mr. Higgins.
Yes, go ahead, Doctor. But please be careful.
Naturally. Anesthetic, Doctor.
Already. Light narcosis.
Moderate.
Don't let them touch me, Daddy.
Oh, they won't hurt you, dear. Just breathe deeply.
I ain't gonna breathe.
Oh, there's nothing to it. See how I sniff it. Nothing.
What?
Of course not. Let me have a sniff too, Doctor. See?
Make the other doctor sniff it, too.
No.
Very well. Oh, it's such a lovely smell, isn't it, Mr. Higgins? Good heavens, he must have taken a deep one.
What happened to my daddy?
What did you give him, Doctor? Why, he's... You too? Nurse, what's going on?
Thank you, Baby Snooks, Daddy, and Company.
Dangerous Assignment, transcribed starring Brian Donlevy as Steve Mitchell.
I get sent to a lot of places I can't even pronounce. They all spell the same thing, though, trouble. But when I walk into the commissioner's office, I don't realize that this assignment's going to wind up with my life being saved by a handful of cigars.
Morning, Commissioner. You sent for me?
Steve, you're going ghost hunting. Ever hear of Eli Bryant?
Eli Bryant? Sounds familiar.
World War II, an American trader. Collaborated with the Japanese in the South Pacific.
Oh, yeah. Finger man, first class. He was killed in 1944 during one of our raids, wasn't he?
So we thought. Eli Bryant is still very much alive, Steve. Been in hiding ever since. According to our information, he's in Australia. Had a plastic surgery job done on his face.
One of our boys get a line on him?
No, a man named Walt Cooper claimed he recognized Bryant in Darwin 2 weeks ago. He contacted us and said we'd hear from him again.
What's his angle?
It looks like he's trying to make some sort of deal.
Putting the squeeze on Eli Bryant? And if that doesn't work, he's going to try to see how much he can get from us.
That looks like it.
Well, have we heard from him again?
I've just heard about him. Cooper's body was found in a ditch on the outskirts of Darwin 3 nights ago.
Looks like he tried to pull the blackmail bite on the wrong man.
Steve, get over there. Find the man who killed Cooper, and I think you'll find Eli Bryant. Well, that's it. You've got your assignment. Good luck.
The National Broadcasting Company is presenting Dangerous Assignment, starring Brian Donlevy in the role of Steve Mitchell. colorful two-fisted government agent. At all those places of the world where danger and intrigue walk hand in hand, there you will find Steve Mitchell on another dangerous assignment. Before we bring you tonight's dangerous assignment adventure, let me tell you about tomorrow's fine comedy on the NBC Radio Network. Yes, tomorrow you'll hear The Bob Hope Show and Fibber McGee and Molly, and Eddie Cantor will bring you his show business show. There's always entertainment when Fibber and Molly open wide the doors at 79 Wistful Vista. And tomorrow, from Palm Springs, California, Bob Hope will have Bing Crosby, Marilyn Maxwell, and Charlie Farrell as his special guests. And Eddie Cantor's show business show will present a program of Italian entertainers. Bob Hope, Fibber McGee and Molly, Eddie Cantor. Yes, hear all three tomorrow on NBC.
Fly to Darwin, Australia, track down the killer of a would-be blackmailer, and I'll probably wind up with a gent named Eli Bryant, American traitor, finger man for the Japanese in World War II. It's late Tuesday afternoon when my plane lands at Darwin, and half an hour later, I'm at police headquarters talking about Cooper's murder with the officer in charge. He brings out a flock of photographs and x-rays.
You see what I mean, Mr. Mitchell? Here.
Yeah.
Wound on the back of Cooper's skull is rather unusual.
No ordinary weapon, that's for sure.
Looks as if he was struck with a club of some sort.
Yeah, and one with spikes in it at that.
Right.
What have you found out about him?
Cooper? Oh, very little. Single, lived in a boarding house, had very few friends. One of them was a man named Fleming, John Fleming, lived at the same address.
You have Fleming in for a talk?
Fleming's here all right, in the morgue. He's dead.
What?
A farmer found Fleming's body in a parked car this morning, some 50 miles south of here.
Don't tell me he was hit with that spiked club.
No, a .45 caliber bullet finished him off.
That killer of ours seems to be having a busy week.
Well, this wasn't the same person, I'm sure.
Oh?
You see, Fleming's death wasn't a deliberate killing, Mr. Mitchell. One of my men telephoned in 2 hours ago with the news that a young lady reported someone had broken into a farmhouse near Murchison Creek last night. She fired a few shots at the man, thought she missed.
It was Fleming?
Yes, a man who must have managed to get back to his car, drive a mile or so.
And then conked out, huh?
Conked? Oh, yes, of course. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Mitchell. Yes? Mr. Pelling, eh? Just a moment. Fleming's employer. I asked him to drop in. Want to talk to him?
Sure.
All right, have Mr. Pelling come in. Pelling runs some sort of a curio shop. Fleming was one of his clerks.
I see.
Come in, Mr. Pelling.
Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, Mr. Pelling.
How do you do?
Mr. Pelling.
Sit down, sir.
I can't tell you what a shock Fleming's death has been to me, gentlemen. Why, he's been with me for years. My best clerk.
You knew him pretty well, then?
Of course. That is, I thought I did.
What do you mean?
Well, he's quiet, dependable, devoted to the store. I was thinking about bringing him in the firm as a partner. And the other day, well, he quit. Just like that. I couldn't understand it.
Mr. Pelling, have you ever met a man called Cooper?
Cooper? Cooper. Let me think.
A friend of Fleming's. He might have been in your store a few times.
No. No, I don't believe I ever met the man.
Well, looks like my next stop is that farmhouse near Murchison Creek and the young lady who plugged Fleming. I'll check with you later, Lieutenant. Raining hard when my train pulls out of Darwin, and raining even harder when I arrive at Murchison Creek Station 3 hours later. It's really out in the middle of nowhere, nothing but rolling plains. I finally get directions to the farmhouse I'm looking for. It's a 1 mile walk in the rain.
Yes? What do you want?
You, Augusta Wells?
That's right.
My name's Mitchell, Steve Mitchell. Here's my credentials.
Big time policeman.
Yeah. Now, how about putting away that .45?
What? Oh, sorry. Come on in. I'm still a little nervous after what happened last night.
Nice place you have here. Run it alone?
My father and I do. Pop's away on a trip to Melbourne.
Business?
Yes. We raise pigs.
I know.
South wind again, hmm?
You're American, aren't you, Miss Wells?
Yes, but make it Gussie. Please never call me Augusta. I was born in a town of the same name. A whim of my parents. I have a brother who was born in Toledo. Aren't I lucky? What were you asking me?
Last night, about,
Oh, there isn't much to say. I heard a noise in the den and came in to investigate. There he was, going out the window.
He didn't stop when you called out?
No, so I let it fly. Didn't know I'd hit him till this morning. One of the farmers down the road told me.
Do you have any idea what the man wanted in the den?
No. Nothing much of value there.
Mind if I have a look?
No. Come ahead. Here we are. I saw him as I opened the door. He was over there by the window.
Uh-huh. And what did...
Well, what is it, Mr. Mitchell? What's wrong?
See in an Australian farmhouse is a wooden cigar store Indian, but there he is, about 5 feet tall. Then I spot something else. Resting by the Indian's foot and carved into the base of the figure is a war club, a wicked-looking weapon with half a dozen spikes sticking out of it.
What's wrong, Mr. Mitchell?
I've suddenly become interested in this.
That war club?
Mm.
It doesn't come loose. It's sort of a permanent fixture, carved right out of the pedestal.
So I see. How long has the chief been in the family?
Only since yesterday afternoon.
Oh?
Gift from a friend of mine, Bertie Slack. He's got a weird sense of humor and a face to match. Last year, he sent me a moose head for my birthday.
Where's Bertie get this, do you know?
In Darwin, a store called Pellens.
Pellens?
Curio shop of some sort. Bertie's a regular customer.
I see. When did he buy it? A
couple of days ago. Why?
The man who broke into your den last night, Fleming, was a clerk at Pellens.
Oh?
Yeah. And a friend of his named Cooper was murdered 4 nights ago with a weapon that could be this war club.
But how? That club is part of the pedestal. You can't swing the whole works.
No, but a man could fall, hit his head against the pedestal.
Oh, sure. Sure, I guess so.
You have a phone?
We're not that civilized.
Look, do you mind if I borrow your redskin friend? I think the police in Darwin might be interested in him and maybe in Mr. Pellen, too.
You mean you want to take the Indian back with you?
Why not?
Well, you'll have to wait until morning. There isn't another train till then.
Oh?
I have a spare bedroom.
Yeah, I noticed.
And a gun.
I noticed that, too.
If you'll help me with the linen and blanket.
Sure. Lead the way, Gussie.
There's an extra blanket in the cupboard if you need it.
Okay, thanks. Hey, wait a minute. Listen.
It's like a truck pulling away. Funny, I didn't hear it approach.
Could have coasted in.
What would a truck be doing around here this time of
That's
night?
That's what I want to find out.
The hall light's right at the bottom of the stairs.
Okay. I want to take a look in the den here. Hey.
The Indian. It's gone.
In just a moment, Steve Mitchell will continue his dangerous assignment. We now bring you an important announcement for all Americans, particularly those of you who run your own business or are in a position to hire employees. This country is now engaged in a gigantic defense program which must be kept on schedule. There's no time to lose. To win, we've got to use every ounce of strength, industrial strength, in this contest to protect ourselves and the free world. That means we've got to give jobs, productive jobs, to all Americans. We've got to hire the handicapped. Thousands of handicapped persons, veterans and non-veterans alike, are ready, willing, and able to work. Thousands of others have proved on the job that when they're properly placed, they do every bit as good a job as their able-bodied fellow workers. So, Mr. Employer, give these folks a chance to help you increase your productive capacity. Hire the handicapped. Help them. Help your business. Help America. And now, back to Dangerous Assignment and Brian Donlevy as Steve Mitchell.
Gussie wheels a small car out of the garage and we take off after the truck. The road is wet from the recent rain, but we slowly gain. Then we come to a steep grade. Gussie comes up alongside the truck, but it suddenly swerves over, trying to crowd us off the road. Gussie hits the brakes. The truck misses us and goes into a skid over the bank. We stop, get out, and climb down to the wreck.
How many are there?
There's only the driver, and he's dead. Yeah, here's the chief, safe and sound in the back.
What are we going to do now?
How far is it to Darwin?
About 70 miles.
Through country like this?
Most of the way. Real rugged, isn't it?
Gussie, I'd feel a lot better if I got the chief there as soon as possible. Do you think you could drive us?
Well, it's going to be a little crowded in this car, but after all, I don't often get a chance to take one man for a ride, let alone two. Come on.
How far have we come?
About halfway.
Oh, fine.
Getting tired?
Well, holding this wooden warrior in my lap is not exactly my idea of comfort.
Steve.
What's the matter?
That bend in the road behind us, some headlights just came round it.
Yeah. Hey, gaining on us, too. Coming up pretty fast.
You think he's after us?
That answer your question?
It sure does.
Step on it.
Trees and pull in behind it. Their car roars past. Then... Hey.
Yeah. The tracks run parallel to the road, about half a mile away.
I thought you said there was no train until morning.
I meant passenger trains. They run a slow freight and cattle train through every night.
I'd settle for that right now, believe me, but I don't suppose I've got a chance of catching it.
Sure we have. Huh? There's a grade right over there. It slows almost to a stop.
Okay, let's start hiking.
Just a little faster and we'll make it.
This baby weighs a ton. Here, I'll try and get it on this flat car. There. Come on, climb aboard.
I sure didn't realize what I was getting into when my friend Bertie sent this chief to me. I'm still a little hazy about some of the details.
I think it breaks down something like this. Helen, the owner of the curio shop where the Indian came from, is actually Eli Bryant, a war trader and collaborator we've been chasing for several years.
I heard his name mentioned during the war.
Yeah, a guy named Cooper found out who Pellin was and tried to blackmail him. In a fight, Cooper got shoved over, hit his head on the chief's club, and it killed him. Pellin carted his body away, but the Indian here is proof of where the murder took place and puts the finger on Pellin.
But this Fleming who tried to break into my house.
Yeah, he was a clerk at Pellin's. He probably tried to pick up the blackmail gag where his friend Cooper had left off. He could have sold the Indian to your friend Bertie so it would be in a safe place. And he could put the pressure on Cullen.
Well, I guess that explains everything.
Hey, they seem to be stopping. What's that up there ahead?
Cattle chutes. Probably going to unload.
Wait a minute. There's a car parked up near the front of the train.
Yeah, the tracks curve around and cross the road.
That's the car that was chasing us. They must have figured the switch and backtrack. Come on, we're getting off on the other side here.
Well, how about the chief?
He's coming with us. There. Hey, look. A ditch beside the roadbed.
Steve, this isn't going to work. You can't get very far carrying the chief.
You got any better ideas?
Yeah, I think I've got my bearings now. This section of the country looks familiar. Could you hide here for a little while with the chief?
Yeah, I guess so. We're out of sight here. Why? What's your idea?
See you later.
The fields. I don't know what her idea is, but I hope it works. All I can do is stay under cover in the ditch with the wooden Indian. 20 minutes later, I hear a sound. A motor of some type, but I can't peg it. It gets closer. Then all of a sudden, Gussie comes wheeling up to the edge of the ditch.
Hi.
What? A motorcycle?
Sure. Complete with sidecar for you and the chief.
Oh, no. Where did you get it?
Some people I know. Live a couple of miles away. I borrowed it from them.
Did you telephone the Darwin police?
No, they don't have a phone there.
Oh, fine. So we hit the road again.
Well, not exactly.
What do you mean?
Might be safer to travel cross country away before cutting back to the road.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Okay, Chief, let's saddle up.
We can probably get back on the road now.
Oh, Anna, couldn't possibly think of a better idea.
There.
Yeah. I don't see any sign of a car behind us. We may have shaken them.
Getting light.
Yeah. Hey, don't tell me.
Hmm?
Civilization. Look, up there beside the road, a farmhouse.
And telephone wires leading to it.
Well, what do you know?
I'll head in behind the back porch there.
Fine.
There. Out of sight of the road now.
Yeah. Come on, Chief. We're dismounting.
See? Looks pretty deserted around here.
Yeah.
Smells musty. Probably been shut up for some time.
There's the phone.
Dead?
Dead.
What do we do now?
That's a good question.
Steve, the front door.
I'll take a peek out the window.
Is it Pellin?
No, I've never seen this guy before. Come here, take a look. Recognize him?
No, I've never seen him either.
He could be working for Pellin.
Who is it?
Name's Bedwell. I need a bit of a helping hand.
Oh? What do you mean?
Well, my automobile is stalled on the road. I'm not much of a hand at tinkering. I thought you might be able to help me.
Steve, it could be a trap.
Yeah, I know, but if it isn't, if he's legit, we can fix his car. It's our best way of getting to Darwin.
I'd say I'm still here.
Here, take the gun, Gussie, and keep me covered all the way. Don't show yourself.
All right, but be careful.
Well, good morning.
Hi. Where is this car of yours?
Oh, see? It's through that clump of trees.
Oh, yeah.
I've been sitting it out most of the night and didn't want to disturb you until it got light.
Okay, let's take a look. I walk to the car with Bedwell, still wondering if it's a trap, but nothing happens. We get to the car. I find a loose distributor wire and fix it. Bedwell gets in and the car starts like a top.
I say...
I guess that was it, all right.
Well, thanks awfully, old boy.
Sure. Are you heading toward Darwin?
Yes. Can I give you a lift?
You sure can.
Hop in.
Well, there are some others back in the house that have to go, too.
Oh, others? Oh, who are they?
One's a girl.
Well, how jolly. Does she have a friend?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes.
Who's the friend?
Well, you may find this a little hard to believe, Mr. Bedwell, but you see...
The friend is a wooden Indian.
What? Helen.
A gun? I say, what is all this popping out from behind trees with talk of wooden Indians?
Get out of the car, quickly.
What happened to the accent, Pellin?
I don't need it anymore.
Well, really?
Now, Mr. Mitchell.
You finally caught up with us.
I certainly did. You see, I found out whom Fleming had sold the Indian to and sent one of my men after it.
The guy in the truck?
Yes. Fortunately, I followed along myself in my car. It's been a long chase, but it's over now.
I say, I really don't know what any of this is all about, but I'm sure it's none of my business. And if you'll excuse me...
Hardly. You were unfortunate enough to happen along at the wrong time.
That Indian proves Cooper was killed at your curio shop. Cooper knew who Eli Bryant was, the collaborator we've been chasing all these years. That sort of makes you Bryant.
Exactly. Now we're all going back to the farmhouse and our friend, the wooden Indian.
Gussie's covering me, but when we get to the door, I realize it's not going to do me any good. Pellin is too smart. He jams his gun against my backbone and yells through the door.
Open up, young lady. And if you have a gun, drop it. Either that or I shoot Mr. Mitchell.
Gussie opens up, drops her gun. Pellin spots the wooden Indian, and I know I've got to think fast because he's due to start shooting any second. Then I get an idea. The wooden Indian is standing beside the table on which the phone sits.
Well, now that I have the Indian...
It's too late, Pellin. The police already know about you. I telephoned them a few minutes ago.
Ah, you're bluffing. This farmhouse is vacant. The phone's been disconnected.
Don't kid yourself. Here, I'll show you. I pick up the phone and walk toward Pellin. I manage to loop the wire over the Indian's outstretched hand, the one that holds the wooden cigars. Pellin takes the phone. Just as he starts to listen, I give the wire a jerk. It pulls the Indian forward into Pellin's gun.
Too late.
All right, Steve?
Sure. Our friend the chief here saved us. Now, if Mr. Bedwell will be kind enough to take us all to Darwin...
A wooden Indian for a friend? A deserted farmhouse? Really, I...
We're not really nuts, Mr. Bedwell. I can explain.
Oh, quiet, quiet. Hey, Bedwell! Come back, Bedwell!
Gussie.
Yeah?
You better crank up your little motorcycle again.
Star, Brian Donlevy, will be back in just a moment. When it comes to knowing the people and facts about show business, you'll find that Eddie Cantor's 42 years in the entertainment world have given him a great backlog of wonderful stories about show people. And every Tuesday evening on the NBC Radio Network, Eddie recounts those intimate little-known stories about your favorite entertainers. So make it a date with Eddie Cantor's show business show for tomorrow and every Tuesday evening. You'll hear the recorded talents of many superb artists. And you'll hear interesting material from Eddie Cantor's memory book. Tomorrow evening, Eddie will present a program of entertainers of Italian backgrounds as he features records by Jimmy Durante, Mario Lanza, Arturo Toscanini, and Tony Arden. Yes, make a date to be in the radio audience tomorrow evening for Eddie Cantor's Show Business Show. It's a regular Tuesday night feature, joining such other fine programs as Fibber McGee and Molly, Bob Hope, and The Cavalcade of America on most stations of the NBC radio network.
Next week, a train trip and a slight case of murder.
That will be Steve Mitchell's dangerous assignment next week. Dangerous Assignment, starring Brian Donlevy as Steve Mitchell with Herb Butterfield as the commissioner, is written by Bob Reif and Adrian John Doe. John Storm speaking. Included in tonight's cast were Kay Stewart, Dan O'Herlihy, Don Morrison, and Ben Wright. Be with us again next week at the same time when Brian Donlevy, starring in the role of Steve Mitchell, will embark on another transcribed Dangerous Assignment. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.